And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and you are listening to and watching the Stomp the Tea podcast. Folks, we have a lot to get into tonight, so let me tell you what you can expect here. We're going to be talking about my latest round of golf, round two for the season. I think I may be turning a corner on playing some respectable golf, which would be amazing, but we'll discuss. We're also going to talk a little bit about Steph Curry. Steph is kind of having a moment with the acquisition of Jimmy Butler to the Warriors. It looks like the Warriors actually have a chance to possibly make another run at a title, which would, if they won, give Steph five. And I kind of want to talk about his place historically. We're also going to talk about a gift that I bought for my wife for her birthday a couple of weeks ago that was, let's just say it was apprehensively received. Not the end of the world, but I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go on. And of course, everyone's favorite segment, what are you drinking tonight? All that and more on this week's episode of Stomp the Tea podcast. But first, folks, I want to talk about how quickly things can change in the course of 1 or 2 weeks in both the NFL and the NBA. It is amazing. You know, just last week, I believe, we were talking about Luka Doncic and the Lakers playing so well. And the Browns having to trade Myles Garrett. Let's take these one at a time. Let's start first with the Lakers. I got to tell you, folks, I watched the Lakers-Celtics game. And I have to say this. It looked to me like Jaylen Brown and the Celtics completely own Luka Doncic. I mean, yes, Luka's always going to get his numbers. He's too talented a player not to score, not to get assists. But I never felt like the Lakers had a chance of winning that game. This was, what, 6 days ago? This was last Friday. We're recording this Thursday night, obviously. I never felt like the Lakers had a chance to actually win the game once LeBron went down. And I can tell you right now, I'm a little concerned about the Lakers' lack of size. It feels like every rebound the Lakers get is a tipped rebound. You know, they have to fight and scrap just to get a rebound offensively or defensively. And they are missing LeBron in the worst way. I have to tell you this. You don't go and play the Celtics when you have, you know, this big marquee matchup. This is Luka's first time playing the Celtics since last year's finals. And he just, I mean, he never got around Jaylen Brown the entire game. I mean, they just locked him up. They picked on him defensively, you know, when the Celtics had the ball. It was not a good game for Luka, even though numbers-wise, once again, he filled up his stat sheet. You just never felt like the Lakers could actually win. They need LeBron and Luka on the floor all the time. And honestly, I think the way Luka plays, it's probably better if either LeBron handles the ball more or you get the ball out of Luka's hands a little bit more. Against the Celtics, Luka had the ball and it would just die in his hands as he failed to get around Jaylen Brown possession after possession after possession after possession. It was pretty tough to watch. I mean, if you're looking at the Lakers as having championship potential, let's see how the Lakers play against some of the better teams without LeBron, because we know they're going to be better with LeBron. But it's not very encouraging that they lose to a bad Brooklyn Nets team on the road. in Brooklyn the following game after putting up that, let's say, a lack of strong effort game against the Celtics. So I thought the Lakers, obviously they were number two at the time we talked about them in the West. I think they're now number four, but none of it matters. I mean, I think two through six are all within two games of each other. So seeding doesn't really matter. But the Lakers need to play better. And Luka needs to play better in order for the Lakers to actually have a true chance to make a deep run in the playoffs. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think they're going to hold LeBron out as long as they can to get him as healthy as they can for the playoffs, which is probably very, very smart. But what you don't want is to have Luka essentially overexert himself and actually get injured while LeBron is out so that LeBron has no one when he comes back. So hopefully JJ and the gang are going to be mindful of that and make the due adjustments accordingly. Now, we also talked a little bit about Myles Garrett. And I remember distinctly saying that the Browns were going to trade Myles Garrett. They're going to have to trade Myles Garrett simply because he doesn't want to be there anymore. Boy, was I wrong. Folks, it looks like the Browns are up to their old tricks once again. What do I mean when I say the Browns are up to their old tricks? Well, we saw it with Deshaun Watson. And we see it now with Myles Garrett. The Browns like to think, okay, this is basically what they say to the rest of the NFL, the Cleveland Browns ownership. They say, well, if we're going to be desperate, for some reason, Siri started talking on my phone. So apologize for the distraction. The Browns and their ownership say to the rest of the NFL, well, if we have to be desperate and overpay to sign players or to re-sign players, aka Deshaun Watson, guaranteeing $230 million, his full contract to play quarterback as a free agent, in a trade, then the rest of the league, you're going to be desperate with this, because what's going to happen after Max Crosby sets the bar for salary for a non-quarterback, high salary for a non-quarterback in the NFL? What do the Browns decide to do? They say, we're not going to pay Myles Garrett $35.5 million, which is what Max Crosby got over 3 years. No. The Browns decide they're going to pay Myles Garrett $40 million a year. I believe over 4 years, that was the extension. Folks, I mean, you're welcome, Jerry Jones. You're welcome, Mike Brown of the Bengals. I mean, if you're those guys, they had to re-sign Micah Parsons. They had to re-sign Ja'Marr Chase. And instead of that top number being $35 million a season, it's now jumped over 40 for those two players. And both Micah and Ja'Marr are going to want 40 plus to re-sign long-term contracts with their current teams. So once again, thank you, Jimmy and D. Haslam, says the rest of the NFL. For overpaying because your franchise is unattractive. What do I think about Myles Garrett signing the deal? Hey, Myles Garrett, make your money. It's not like you're not worth $40 million a year, a season to play. You've been tremendous since you came into the league, and I have no doubt you will continue to be tremendous. $40 million a season. It's a lot of money for a non-quarterback. And I think that things are just going to continue to skyrocket. If you're Roger Goodell, I'm sure your partners, your other owners, have been giving him an earful about the latest move financially from the Haslams. Boy, oh boy, they can't wait to get Jimmy and Dee out of this league, I'm sure. Who knows? I don't know. But I suspect that that wasn't a very popular move from the other owners in the NFL. But it is what it is. And let's be fair, at least the Commanders did not get Myles Garrett, which I think the Commanders could have paid that if they chose to. And that would have been a problem for the Eagles. By the way, I want to show you my latest t-shirt. This is courtesy, not courtesy, I paid for it in cash, so it wasn't a gift. But this is produced by Scheib Vintage Sports, an outfit here in Philadelphia. This is the t-shirt. Yes, we won that John, right? And that's an eagle flying with a Lombardi trophy. You can see that, obviously, if you're watching on YouTube. And I just described it if you are listening on Spotify or Apple. Go to ShyVintageSports.com. They have all sorts of Eagles gear there. So that's the deal on how quickly things can change in the NBA and the NFL. Now, folks, I want to tell you a little bit about my golf game. I think I may actually be turning a corner. Now, I don't know if you remember this or not, but I talked, probably episode 2 or 3. We were in St. Kitts at the time. And I think I told you all that I found something, I think, with my golf game. What did I find? I found that if I shorten my backswing, I've always had a very long, languid backswing. I mean, literally, my golf swing, the club, when I take it back, it's so long that the shaft of my club hits the back of my left shoulder. It is that long of a swing, right? Now, I decided in St. Kitts to try to shorten that swing. I wasn't trying to go John Rahm or Tony Finau short, but I did shorten it quite a bit. I think in St. Kitts, it was probably about half. I probably got the club perpendicular to the ground and then came through. And yesterday, during my round of golf, I got the club. It was almost like a perpendicular as well, but it felt more Finau-like in the backswing. Not as quick, though. And I got to tell you, folks, I'm keeping the ball in front of me. It's really, really encouraging, I have to say. Where did I play? I played a course called, let's see, it's the Union League Liberty Hill course. This is a course that the Union League, it's a private club, social club, but they own a couple golf courses. They bought this a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago, this course. It's in Lafayette Hill. It's out there with so many other private Philadelphia area golf clubs. Philadelphia Country Club is out that way. Philadelphia Cricket Club is out there. Cricket and Golf Club is out there. Manufacturers Golf and Country Club is out that way. Lulu, White Marsh Country Club. There are a ton. There's about 8 to 10 private country clubs for golf, all in this one little area about 15 minutes outside of the city. So I've played this course before. Oh, let me show you the scorecard. This is what the scorecard looks like. For those of you watching on YouTube, that's the Liberty Hill scorecard. Folks, I have to tell you, it's really, really, really encouraging. Now, I still shot a lousy score. Why? Because I'm a lousy golfer. Not the end of the world. But I'm improving. And that is what is so encouraging. Folks, I have to tell you, I'm trying. Every year, I set a couple goals for myself on the for the golf season. You know, I'm still here in the Northeast. So as a result, there is a playing season. There are about 3 to 4 months out of the year where you can't play golf. So this year, I've decided to really try and focus on my scoring. I really want to try to make sure that I score under 150% of all the rounds that I play. They're like, under 100? It's high. What are you talking about? Under 100? You should be shooting 85. I'm a lousy golfer. I shoot 100 more than I shoot 99. Trust me. So, it's not the end of the world. Again, it's not how I make my money. You know, if it was that upsetting to me, I'd play more golf, or I'd take more lessons, or I'd do both. Doesn't bother me that much, but I do want to get better. So, let me tell you a little bit about this round. Folks, I have to tell you, I scored as well on the par threes as I've ever scored on any round in my life. That's how, I'm telling you, that's how you can tell I'm making progress. Historically, for me, I blow up, it's usually double par on all the par threes, and double par or nine on all the par fives. And I can get a bogey or double bogey on the par fours. That's generally how my scorecard looks, right? Yesterday, four par threes, bogey on every single par three, with literally a shot, a real shot, to make par on three of those four par threes. It was unbelievable. I mean, I'm really starting to keep the ball in front of me. Now, my biggest issue with my game at this point is I tend to run out of gas on the back nine. Wouldn't it happen yesterday? Yesterday happened on holes 16, 17, and 18. I just couldn't get off the tee. And I can hit shots. You know, I pitched really well. My chipping was actually not that bad either. Still having problems out of the sand, but that's another story. But I run out of gas. I have to be able to get off the tee in order to actually get through a hole. And if I can't get off the tee, 16, 17, 18, it completely wrecks my scorecard. So we're working on that. I wanted to give you the update on that. By the way, Liberty Hill, you know, I've played it a couple times. Fun course. Lots of elevation changes, interesting course, and it's always in pretty good shape. So if you're in the Philadelphia area and you have a friend who's a member of the Union League, it's certainly worth going out to play. Although I like their course, they have a course in Torresdale, which is kind of in Northeast Philadelphia, which I like actually better. It's actually a better course. But Liberty Hill is fun. It's fun to play. They do a good job with it. All right. Folks, at this point, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you to always make sure you show support for this show. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to subscribe. Tell your friends. Tell your enemies. Tell anyone with ears how much of a fan you are of the Stomp the Tee podcast. We are here for you week in, week out, regardless of the cost, physically, emotionally, or any other costs that we may incur. We are here for you because we want to provide you with content that you are not going to get anywhere else. So don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to tell everyone you know how much you enjoy this podcast. All right, folks, let's talk a little bit about Steph Curry. You know, there's been quite the conversation of late with Steph acquiring, I should say, with the Warriors acquiring Jimmy Butler. It looks like Steph may actually be able to go on a run and maybe contend for his fifth NBA title, which would put him in pretty rarefied air. The discussion has been, we all know that Steph is one of the greatest shooters, if not the greatest shooter, in the history of the NBA. But does he start to merit discussion of being one of, if not the greatest player in the history of the NBA? If, this is my codicil, he wins a fifth championship. All right. My answer to that question is no. I think Steph Curry is a tremendous player. He's an all-time great, obviously. But I think Steph could win six championships. I'll put it like that. And I still wouldn't think that he's the greatest player of all time. But is Steph Curry one of the 10 greatest players in the history of the NBA? Now that, to me, is a much better question. And that is a question that I will answer right now. Folks, I'm going to give you my list. And this is just my list of the 10 greatest players in NBA history. You tell me what you think about it. I'm going to explain how I got there. And we'll talk about any notable omissions as well. But first, the list. My 10 greatest NBA players of all time. And this is in no particular order. You can order them however you want. But I'm just going to read them off. Wilt Chamberlain, Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Magic Johnson, Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Oscar Robertson, and Steph Curry. Yes, Steph makes my top 10 of all time. Folks, you have to understand, there are certain things that come to the fore where you may be on the fence about one issue or two issues, and something happens, and it kind of tips the scales one way or another. I can tell you exactly, I'll give you an example of when that happened for me. For the vast majority of my adult life, I always thought that Magic Johnson was the greatest player in NBA history. And I've told this story before. Until I saw Jordan play the flu game against Utah. And when you saw him in that game do what he did in a finals setting to win the game, with help, obviously, of his teammates, but Jordan just willed himself through that game with unbelievable contributions. I said, that's it. I don't like Michael Jordan. I mean, not personally. I'm a Knicks fan, so, I mean, he bothered me forever. And he beat my team a lot. But when I saw that, I said, I have to give it up. Michael Jordan is the greatest player in the history of the NBA. That's an example of, you know, a scale-tipping kind of piece of evidence that you see, that you witness, that you hear, that you're present for. For me, Steph Curry, his performance at this year's Olympics in the gold medal game in the last 5-10 minutes was unbelievable. Folks, if you don't remember, He hit shot after shot in a tight game, I think it was against France, for the gold medal. In France, obviously. He put on such a show, and even with all the championships that he's won with Golden State, Steph being, as David Stern used to say, the star of stars during the All-Star game, Steph was the star of stars during that gold medal game. And it really convinced me that he belongs in the top 10 in the history of the game of basketball. Think about it. The way people play basketball now has literally changed largely because of Steph Curry. The three has never been more popular as a form of offense, as a weapon, as an approach to trying to win games than it is now. And that is largely because of Steph Curry. Now, I want you to think about something. Folks, think about some of the greatest shooters in the history of the game, right? Larry Bird, Reggie Miller. I mean, if you want to go back, let's say Rick Barry, Ray Allen, all tremendous long-range shooters, snipers. And yet, the game wasn't played differently because they were in the league. Steph did that. Steph changed how people approach scoring and trying to win basketball games, an offensive philosophy for not only college, but NBA, not only NBA, but college and high school as well. People are in love with the three-point shot now. And more than ever, and that's largely because of Steph Curry. And he changed the game. Now, we can talk about some notable omissions that I have. And I have them written down here. You know, on my top 10, there's no Larry Bird. There's no Shaq. There's no Jerry West. There's no Elgin Baylor. There's no Moses Malone. There's no Bob Pettit. There's no Isaiah Thomas, no Hakeem Olajuwon, no Dr. J, no Kevin Durant. All great players in their own right, without question. But you can be an all-time great without being one of the top 10 players in the history of the league. Very few seats on that bus. By definition, there are only 10. And it's hard to get one of those seats. So I have to say, one of the reasons, let me tell you a couple of reasons why I left a couple of the people off. Let's start with Jerry West, who's often talked about, you know, people call him the logo because allegedly the logo for the NBA was fashioned off of Jerry West dribbling a basketball. West, from my understanding, I never saw him play, was a tremendous player. I believe he's the only player in NBA history to win a finals MVP on a losing team. But that's part of the problem. Jerry West won one championship, but he was 0-6 against the Celtics. 0-6. Elgin Baylor, tremendous Laker, one of the all-time great Lakers. He was 0-7, I believe, against the Celtics, right? Larry Bird, tremendous player, all-time great, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful all-around player, could do it all. Larry Bird was 1-2 against Magic Johnson and the Lakers in the NBA. You could say he was 1-3 against Magic, if you include the national championship game, Michigan State versus Indiana State. I mean, folks, think about it this way. Wilt Chamberlain, who gets all kinds of grief for only winning two championships, one with the Philadelphia Warriors, I believe, and one with the 72 Lakers, right? People kill Wilt for not winning more often, but he has two championships. And in one of them, he beat Bill Russell and the Celtics. That goes a long, long, long way historically, because very few people did that. If you were Jerry West, if you were Elgin Baylor, if you were Larry Bird, you have to find a way to beat the Lakers, your arch nemesis, at least once. Now, Larry did it once. But you would like to see Larry Bird have done it twice. And he didn't. He only did it once. So, folks, I have to tell you, that is my list. Top 10 all time. Let me know what you think about that. All right. Folks, I want to get into a topic that I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to actually mention it. My wife had a birthday in February, a couple weeks ago. More than a couple weeks ago, but you get the point. I bought her a gift. Now, I got to tell you, folks, the problem I have with shopping for my wife is that oftentimes I blow the whole wad idea-wise for Christmas. Christmas is, you know, obviously 2 months earlier. Christmas is December 25th. My wife's birthday is February 21st. It's a week after Valentine's Day. And for years now, I've thought of all these great Christmas presents to give her, but when I buy them, I'm like, oh no, I got to think about something to buy for her birthday, which is a huge, huge pain. Because when you're out of ideas, it's very difficult to get creative. So that being said, in recent years, I've kind of been holding back a little bit more. It's like, let's kind of, you know, put a Christmas present possibly in our back pocket and give it to her for her birthday so that, you know, there's less brain power involved and everyone walks away happy. So this year, I decided to buy my wife a Wolf convection oven for her birthday. Now, most of you folks probably know the brand Wolf. They make ovens and things of that nature, like in-wall ovens, ranges, cooktops. They also make a toaster oven, basically. This convection oven is a very, very, very fancy toaster oven. And I bought it for my wife for her birthday. Now, the only problem is I bought it for her on December 30th. Why? Because I got it for a good number. It was on sale. Wolf is almost never on sale. It was on sale. I got like $100 off on this thing. So I bought it on December 30th. It was delivered in like first week of January. I held it for 6 weeks until her birthday, wrapped it up. Happy birthday, honey. And she opens it. Now, something you need to understand about my wife, Donna. She is gorgeous, by the way, still to this day. Incredibly smart, intelligent, wonderful match. We make quite a pair. But she happens to be very, very practical, which is not the worst thing in the world. I could use a little practicality, to be honest. Yeah, I could probably use a little practicality. So, she's very practical, And her first thought was, she said, "Thank you, this is great." Then the inevitable but. She said, "But I think it's too big for our kitchen." I'm like, you know, thinking ahead, honey, I measured. There are three different places in our kitchen that it will fit on the counter space. It'll be great. And once you open this up and start using it, I think you're going to love it. In fact, I know you're going to love it. To which she responds, "Yes, I think I would love it as well, but I think it's too big for our kitchen." Folks, oh my gosh, what a disaster. Folks, if you know anything about the Wolf brand, if they don't give them away. They're not cheap, right? So, as I've been known to do in the past, I take it all in stride. I'm like, "Okay, honey, look, it's your gift. You can do whatever you want with it," right? And she thinks about it for a few days and kicks it around. Honestly, I happen to think that she tries to envision some of these spaces that I suggested that the Wolf could fit and operate functionally. And I think in the end, she just couldn't quite get there mentally. So she says, "This past Sunday, let's return it." I'm like, "Fine, dear. That's fine. It is your gift. You can do whatever you want with it." So we drive together. This thing is about 55 pounds. So I'm not going to say, "You take it back." Obviously, I'm going to go with her and carry it into the store and not exchange it, but return it, get our money back, let her buy something else. So the problem is that I bought this thing on December 30th, right? I bought it on December 30th, the day before New Year's Eve. And apparently, which is not that surprising, but something I hadn't considered, there is a 30-day window for you to return an item like that to William Sonoma. So we get to the store. I bring the Wolf oven in the box, still unopened. And they're like, "Yeah, let me get my manager. I don't know if you can return this." And they say, "It's been too long." Okay. Now, I don't want to say I wasn't disappointed, but I will say I was thrilled that we could not return it. I mean, I got to be honest. Who doesn't want a Wolf toaster oven? Come on. But my wife was a little annoyed that we couldn't return it because now she has to figure out whether or not she can live with this thing sitting on a counter in our kitchen, which in her mind takes up too much space, which is fair, which is definitely, definitely fair. So we are currently on a Wolf watch. This happened 5 days ago, guys. So 5 days ago, we tried to return it. We found out it's not returnable. The box is still in our dining room, unopened. Now, for a little context, you have to understand, I give my wife all kinds of gifts over the years. Some tech, some not tech. But sometimes she takes her time opening things. I remember I gave her a TiVo 1 year. For those of you who don't know, TiVo was like one of the original like hard drive recorders for television. You could record TV shows on it. It held so much amount of space. And it took her a while to open that. I gave her an Alexa, I think a year after they came out. and it took her 6 months to open the box and set it up. So sometimes she takes her time. So we are now on a wolf watch. I want to find out, folks, how long it takes her to open this wolf convection oven, place it on a counter so that we can start using it. Now, I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to leave it alone. But I will keep you informed week to week. Right now, we are currently on day 5. Keep that number in mind. And I will let you know, not only next week, if we get to day 12, 7 days from now, but the moment it gets opened, I will record a special 30-second, 1-minute video letting you know the wolf watch is over, whatever day that occurs on. But regardless, I'll update you every single week here on the Stomp the Tea podcast as to whether or not she's actually opened the box and we are using the wolf convection oven. All right, folks. Now we come to my and your favorite part of the show, where I get to ask you a question. What are you drinking tonight? Well, folks, I can tell you what I'm drinking. And that is Old Scout straight bourbon whiskey. Folks, let me tell you a little bit about this product, who does it, and my thoughts on it. I can tell you right now, Old Scout, it is bottled by Smooth Ambler Spirits Company out of Maxwellton, West Virginia, and it is distilled in Indiana. So, before we go any further, this bourbon is sourced. Again, out of Indiana, probably MGP, but who knows? They don't say. But as we talked about many, many, many times before, sourced whiskey is not the worst thing in the world. As long as you know it's sourced, you can live with it. And sometimes, you know, sourced is not always bad. It's just not from the people who are actually bottling the product. So it's good to know that either way. I got this bottle for $50. It is 6 years old, the bourbon. And the mash bill is 60% corn, 36% rye, 4% malted barley. This is a high rye bourbon. Now, folks, we talked about Smooth Ambler before, probably about 3-4 episodes ago. I debuted the Smooth Ambler Founders Cask Strength Series, which, as I told you then, is in the running for Whiskey of the Year for What Are You Drinking Tonight? And I have no reason to feel differently about that tonight. But this, it is spicy. It's very spicy neat. Almost too spicy. It's spicy. It's so spicy when you drink it neat that it can be difficult to discern some of the subtler flavor profiles that this bourbon actually exhibits. But I will say this: if you put it on ice, if you actually put some water in it, just a splash, a couple drops or two, it really opens up and it changes the whole bourbon to a spicy, sweet, very strong savory feel and taste. I don't like it as much as the Founders, what is that called? The Founders Cask Strength series, but I like it a lot. It's completely worth having your bar, especially at $50. Although I wouldn't drink it very often neat. I really wouldn't. I would put it on the rocks. I would put it a cube in there I would have it with water, a splash or two. But it is completely worth having in your bar. Old Scout. Straight bourbon whiskey. I've got to give you the numbers on this. This is 58.9% ABV. So it packs quite a punch. That's the reason it's so spicy. Folks, that is the show for tonight. I want to thank you all for joining us as always. We will be back here for you next week with another scintillating episode full of wonderful content offerings. But until then, as always, my name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. And as always, we will see you on the first tee.